session number 12608, Rule 2.
Mr. Hibbert, Rule 2.
I don't really think that that sort of thing can be spotted in selection. I think that it is the sort of thing which only happens when under real stress, and I don't think that one can see it beforehand.
But how did pilots view going on to an operation, say, the night before? Would you would everybody be silent and contemplative or excited or worried or what?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, one behaved absolutely normally, and you went drinking to the local pub or in the mess in absolutely the normal way. You knew the night before that you were on the battle order, and that was as much as you really knew until you were briefed the next morning. Of course, you didn't know what the target was going to be, nor did you actually know that there was going to be a raid the next day. You actually just knew that if there was going to be one, you were on the battle order.
Were people superstitious? Did they have lucky charms and so on?
No, I don't think anyone carried any lucky charms that I'm aware of, nor do I think that people were superstitious. I think that one very much liked to fly what you termed your own aeroplane, your own aircraft, and I think that also very much you like to fly with your own crew, and you are less happy if for some reason or other your own air gunner or your own navigator couldn't come with you. You prefer to have your own crew with you.
Did that really make so much difference, do you think?
I think so. I think it was a feeling. You knew how your own crew were going to behave. You knew what their reactions were going to be. And you had faith in them, of course, because you kept your own crew throughout. I joined up with my navigator and air gunner right at the time that we were at Upwood, before we joined the squadron. We joined the squadron as a crew.
What was the background of the personnel of the squadron?
Oh, all sorts and types and classes. There was no way of wartime, I think, and particularly aircrew, was a great leveller. There were no classes, and there were no... You didn't really know what people had done. I do remember that one squadron leader had been a salesman with Harrods. One of the air gunners had been a bookie. I don't really think of the rest. I don't think one knew very much about them. It's not the sort of thing which one discussed very much. You just accepted them for what they were and who they were.
Were they all British?
No, they weren't all British. There were several Canadians and several New Zealanders on the squadron at that time. And the Canadians and New Zealanders, the Canadians particularly, were very good types. We also, at one stage, had one American with us who was a very nice guy as well, and sadly he was killed later on in the war. But they were all very good pilots. Particularly the Canadians were very good pilots. We respected them.
Did the non-British people have any different approach to the war or to fighting?
No, I don't think so at all. Nor do I think that they ever felt that they were any different to us. We were all fighting for the same purpose, and of course we were all flying for the same objective.
Did the local population make much of you in your leisure time?
Yes, particularly in Norfolk. The Norfolk people were very friendly once they got to know you. we had a local, when we were at Swanton Morley, we had a local pub in East Durham, which we always used to go to every night, and there were a lot of local people there who became very good friends with the members of the squadron. I mean, there was a local farmer there who was good, a very good type. There was another one who was a local estate agent, and they used to invite you to their houses for meals and that sort of thing.
Did you ever come across hostility from civilians?
Never of any sort at all.
What, from the operational point of view, was the next step in your memory?
Well, then the whole squadron had a short attachment to Drem in Scotland, and that was in 1944 in March. And by that time, we'd actually moved from Swanton Morley, and we were based at what was then Hartford Bridge, and is now Blackbush, which is near Camberley. We had that operation, we had that detachment to Drem, and then shortly after that,
I think there that you were doing experiments on window.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, actually, the whole squadron went up to Drem, but then later on I went up on my own with my crew and did the window experimental work, which was interesting. I think what had happened was that we had managed to get hold of some German radar equipment, and the object of my exercise up there was to see what effect the dropping of window had on the German equipment. And I was sent up there with, as I say, I was sent up there with my crew, and was met by a wing commander, Jackson, and a civilian by the name of Mr. Friend, and it was they who briefed us on what to do. And I was up there for several weeks before returning to the squadron. And immediately after that, I then went on rest.
What was the effect? Did you find out?
No, I didn't know. No, I mean, we were never told the results of our experimental work. We were just told to fly out to sea, hours out to sea, at a specific height, and throw out bundles of window, so many bundles a minute, and that was the. What we were told to do, and that was in March, April 1944.
Just thrown out by hand?
Yeah, absolutely, just thrown out by hand.
And then?
And interestingly enough, I have a Sunday Telegraph cutting from 1978, which is discussing the use of window in the bomber offensive, which I'll give to you as a matter of interest.
How necessary was it for you to have this rest after your tour?
It was a recognised thing that after a tour of operations, which in the case of our squadron was 30 operations, you went on rest for 6 months. And that was regularised thing, and I think actually, yes, I think I would have to say that at that time I was ready to go on rest. I think I was beginning, as it were, to get a bit twitchy. But having gone on rest, within a month I was longing to get back to the squadron again, and in fact I was making applications to do so, but I didn't actually get back to the squadron until 6 months had expired.
But how did the twitchiness manifest itself?
Oh, I think that one was nervous and conscious of fear.
But
and I suppose also I think that people did begin to get the shakes, probably were drinking too much and all that sort of thing. I think it did have an effect on people.
You mean the handshake?
Yes, yes, yes.
And sleeplessness?
Don't know so much about sleeplessness, but I think that people were conscious of being highly strung at that time. You know, towards the end of a tour of operations, you were conscious of probably needing a rest, needing to get away from it.
Would it lead to outbursts and arguments? Friction between...
Could do, yes. Yes, it could do.
And so you've done 22 operations?
I've done 32 operations at that time.
Then you finally did get back after your application.
Yes, I rejoined the same squadron, by which time the squadron were at Vitry-en-Artois, which is near Douai in France, and I rejoined them there. I rejoined them there in December 1944, and by that time I was so keen that I actually went on my first operational flight, having rejoined the squadron. I went actually as a passenger, really just for the fun of it. I mean, it seems a strange thing to do, but that's what I did. And that was on a marshalling yards in Germany. And again, I stayed with the squadron, and we were doing troop concentrations, railway bridges, road junctions, really close army support at that time, and that went on right the way through. And I have here January the 5th, 1945, troop concentration in the German spearhead, and then another day.
Which German spearhead?
Well, I couldn't actually tell you offhand. It just, my logbook again just says road junction and German spearhead.
How did you like doing this tactical support of the army? As compared with what you'd done before?
I think that it called for much greater accuracy, and we were, in fact, at that time, we were very much controlled from the ground, and in some ways we weren't too happy about that. In other words, instead of being able to do your own thing, you had some chap sitting in a caravan up with the front line forces telling you exactly you know, what course to fly and what height to fly at, and when to open your bomb doors and when to drop your bombs. So you were totally controlled from the ground, and I don't think we were too happy about that.
So you were like an automaton?
We were very much so, yes, yes, yes. But we were doing, I see on February the 15th that year, we did a road junction in aid of the Canadian 5th Army advance.
Whereabouts was that?
That I couldn't tell you. It just says road junction in aid of Canadian 5th Army advance, small amount of heavy flak. And then the next day again, no, in fact later on in the same day again, a road junction in aid of Canadian 5th Army advance, no flak.
So did this mean all the fun had been taken out of it?
I think a certain amount of the initiative and own control was taken out of it, yes. Yeah. But, you know, it was very, obviously very necessary work.
Were there ever any occasions when our own forces were hit, or that our own forces accused the
There were occasions, yes. I don't think that we were actually involved with that, but I mean, one was aware of these occasions and one heard about them. But I don't believe, as far as I can recall, that our own squadron was involved with it.
How did you distinguish Allied forces on the ground?
Well, you didn't actually see them. I mean, you were just led on to the target, as I say, by some chap up with the front line. I mean, we were told what the target was, where it was. Here we are, Mönchengladbach was one. Gun position near Uden. Gelden, Zanten, to disrupt communication in the town. Another one, March the 2nd of that year, Cavalier did not bomb as the radar was US, and our own troops were only about 1,000 yards away. So it was pretty close army support.
What's the meaning of Cavalier?
Cavalier was a place. Yes, we were going to a place called Cavalier. I don't know now exactly where that was. And here again, another one, railway bridge over the Rhine at Wesel, marshalling yards at Holten, north of the Ruhr. So we were doing a lot of that sort of work at that particular time, and we were flying quite a lot of operational sorties at that time. We did one on the 1st, another one on the 2nd, another one on the 3rd, another one on the 10th, 12th, 13th, two on the 13th, which for that type of a squadron, that was a lot of flying. We didn't really do as much as that at any other time during the war. And this was all in the run-up to Battle of the Rhine crossing. I have a note in the logbook here. March the 23rd, troop concentration, town of Anholt, some inaccurate flak, and 2100 hours was HR. The Battle of the Rhine crossing is D-Day number 2.
Did you see anything of the airborne descent of the Rhine?
I don't remember seeing that, although we must have done, but I don't actually remember it. No, I don't remember that at all.
When you hear about these instances that we hear about today of friendly fire,
yes.
Do you find it easy to comprehend?
Very easy indeed, yes, very easy indeed. I think that it is sad that so much was made of it this time. I can well understand how that sort of thing can happen. You know, you're as we were, you say here, we were bombing within 1,000 yards of our own troops. And particularly in those days, I mean, the bombing wasn't all that accurate.
How did you find it operating from continental airfields like Vitry-en-Artois?
There we were actually stationed in a chateau which was about 3 miles away from the airfield. I think the French people, of course, having had German occupation, were very happy to see us. Again, you know, if you went into Douai and went into a pub, went into a restaurant or a bar of any sort, they were very friendly, understandably so.
Did you ever come across hostility from French civilians?
No, I don't think so. I do think that Belgium was slightly different. I think the Belgians tended to, I don't think that we had the same feeling to the Belgians as we did to the French.
Why not?
I think we felt that they were out to rip us off.
Overcharging you?
Yes, exactly, yes. But of course, France really was much worse off than Belgium, and Holland was actually worse off in terms of food and supplies, worse off than any of the others. Holland really had a very difficult time, far more so than Belgium, I think.
You operated from Gilserijen,
yes.
From 22nd of April 1945. Where is Gilserijen?
It's between Tilburg and Breda in Holland. Not very far from Eindhoven, all that sort of area.
What did you see of the food supply conditions for the Dutch civilians then?
I think that one found that the Dutch civilians were very, very hard up for food. In France, of course, they were hard up for things like coffee and tea and those sorts of things. And there was a big black market in that and cigarettes. But Holland, they were just desperately short of food.
Was there anything you were able to do for them?
Not a lot, really, no.
Did children come begging round the airfield for food?
No, not round the airfield, but if you went into Breda and Tilburg, as we did, there was an officers' club there. A lot of civilians were very happy to be able to get into the club and be invited in and get food and that sort of thing. But one was certainly conscious of it in Holland, very much so.
Now, there was in December 44, January 45, the famous Ardennes Offensive.
Yes.
And there was a German Air Force attack on airfields, mainly in Belgium. Did that affect you at all?
No, we were never attacked. There was an attack on the one of our other squadrons who were stationed at Brussels Melsbroek. And Melsbroek was attacked at that time, but we were not. That was still when we were still at Vitry.
What happened to you at the time of VE Day?
VE Day, we were flying right up to VE Day. I'm just looking to see. Here we are. Yes. That was May the 7th. We had a practice formation. Today the Germans asked us to accept their unconditional surrender. Now the previous operation to that I had flown on was on April the 26th when we did some marshalling yards north of Hamburg.
But on VE Day you were in Gilserijen?
And we were still in Gilserijen, yes. And that was the end of the war, and of course there was no operational flying after that. I see that on 3 days later we took some army personnel, I think it was, and did a tour of the Ruhr and Cologne and Hamm and Essen and Düsseldorf and that sort of thing, a Cook's tour show, looking at the damage.
How did that impress you?
Oh, it was absolutely, I remember Cologne particularly, as we came up to Cologne at low level, it was absolutely flat, and the only thing that was standing up was the cathedral. It was a most extraordinary sight, but virtually the whole of that area was flat.
Did you feel any sense of guilt about it?
No, none at all. None at all.
Did any of the German civilians speak to you?
No, because we were not on the ground in Germany at that time. So one had no contact with German civilians until very much later on. I see also that on June the 10th, there was a big flypast of 2,000 aircraft from the 2nd Tactical Air Force and the United States 8th and 9th Air Forces for the benefit of Marshal Zhukov, who was the CNC of the Russian Occupational Forces, and we flew past the Scheife headquarters at Frankfurt.
What during the war was your own personal attitude towards the enemy?
I think one can say that one had a very impersonal attitude to it. I can honestly say that although I dropped a considerable number of bombs during the war, I can't with any certainty say that I ever killed anyone. I don't know what happened to my bombs. I think it's very likely that some of them did kill someone, but one can honestly say that you don't know that you ever killed anyone. Whereas if you were a fighter pilot, of course, it was a very different story. As a fighter pilot, you were on a one-to-one basis. But I think that is a very interesting and it's something which I thought about a lot since the war. That I can. It was a very impersonal war.
But did you hate the Germans as an enemy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't remember feeling any great animosity and feeling that I wanted to kill Germans. I was just doing a job. I was doing what I was told to do. I don't know that I felt any particular animosity against them. I don't think any of us did, really. I don't remember ever anyone saying, you know, let's go out and kill some of these bloody Germans or anything of that sort.
Did you ever feel any doubt about the outcome of the war?
No, I don't think so. No, I think one always felt that in due course. I think one felt that perhaps it was going to go on longer than it really did, than it eventually did. And certainly when the Germans were having their push and they were bombing Brussels, Millsbrook and those sorts of things, and the Arnhem offensive was going on, yes, one began to wonder then just what was going to happen. Certainly had a thought that maybe we were going to get pushed back, but that thought didn't last very long.